Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. Tonight, 10,000 steps. You may be familiar with the goal. It's become the gold standard for daily exercise, especially if you have one of those fitness trackers. But where exactly did it come from? Is it science or just clever marketing? And do you really need to hit that goal every day? Walk this way and we'll find out. Now that spring has sprung and we emerge from our winter hibernation, thoughts sometimes turn to doing a little updating in the place we call home. So with budget squeezed by the affordability crisis, what should you expect if you do decide to do some renovations over the next 6 months? What are some of the big trends that we're seeing? HGTV's Kenny Brain is with me to provide some sound advice. But first, an investigation is underway tonight in Baltimore after a container ship slammed into a bridge overnight Tuesday, causing it to collapse in just seconds. The ship's captain managed to issue a mayday call as the vessel was going through an apparent power failure, a catastrophic one, allowing police to stop traffic on the bridge, but six members of a road crew doing repairs are missing, presumed dead tonight. So how could a ship built in 2015 have suffered such an apparently catastrophic power failure? How and why did the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse so quickly in just a matter of seconds? And what does this disaster and tragedy mean for the people of Baltimore? You know, when work ends, often I go home, I can't fall asleep right away. So sometimes I read or I watch something, or sometimes I scroll through social media. And that's what I was doing last night around 10:30 p.m., just a little bit later, when images started to appear on what used to be called Twitter of this bridge being struck by what seemed to be a large container ship and the bridge just collapsing in a matter of seconds. And I had to watch it again and again and again because it was almost surreal to watch it happen, to see the bridge just crumble like it was made of matchsticks. Right away, you knew that if it was what it looked to be, that it was going to be something absolutely terrible. The scale of the tragedy, of course, early on was unknown. How many cars, how many vehicles were on that bridge? Who else was on that bridge? What about the people on the ship itself? Well, today we're learning more and more. So let's start tonight in Baltimore, where that bridge collapse happened overnight last night, 1:30 in the morning, local time. The search for survivors continued throughout the day today after that ship apparently lost power and rammed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge, causing the structure to collapse in a matter of seconds and plunge into the river below. Video of the incident, as I was mentioning, shows the almost the entire length of the bridge collapsing in the Patapsco River below. Here's sound of Baltimore City Fire Dispatch at the time of the collapse.
Unit responding to press alarm I-695. Be advised, the entire Key Bridge has now collapsed into the water. The entire Key Bridge has now collapsed into the water. Proceed with caution. It's 152.
Indeed. We learned today, according to Maryland Governor Wes Moore, that operators of the ship issued a mayday call moments before that collision that happened around 1:30 a.m. local time. Here's how those living nearby described it.
It's unbelievable. I've been in this neighborhood 57 years. I remember when they started building that bridge and can't believe it's gone. It sounded like a big bash of thunder. And then, just like I say, felt like an earthquake. The whole house vibrated like my house was falling down.
Officials say two people were rescued and six people are still unaccounted for. All of them were believed to be part of a crew working to fix potholes on that bridge. Late today, the Coast Guard said that based on the length of time of the search, the water temperatures, they don't believe they will find the victims still alive. So they've suspended that search effort overnight. There will be a continued recovery effort first thing tomorrow morning when the water conditions and other conditions are more favorable. The Singaporean flagged 299-meter container ship called the Dali was leaving the port of Baltimore, setting off on a weeks-long journey to Colombo in Sri Lanka when it appears to have lost power about 30 minutes after departure. The investigation, again, is just beginning, but there's nothing to suggest that this was anything but a horrific accident.
The preliminary investigation points to an accident. We haven't seen any credible evidence of a terrorist attack. We can confirm that the crew notified authorities of a power issue.
That is Maryland Governor Wes Moore there. Synergy Marine Group, which manages the ship, said all crew members and the two pilots who were on board were accounted for. There were no reports of any injuries. But there are many questions tonight about how that ship, built only in 2015 in South Korea, could have suffered such a potentially catastrophic failure. And the bridge itself, the Francis Scott Key Bridge, it's about 2.63 kilometers long with a 366 meter span that carried all this interstate traffic across the bridge and the outer Baltimore Harbor. It was the third longest span of any continuous truss bridge in the world. So what happened to it? How did it collapse so quickly? The focus, of course, today has been on the search and rescue effort. And as mentioned, that effort was called off this evening. Let's start in the city itself. Now, this is a community that many of us may know for its sports teams. Maybe we watch The Wire and so on. But that port is the beating heart of that city. It was built around shipping, around being on the water. And it's a community trying to come to terms with tragedy and disaster tonight. Joining me now is Rachel Gutman-Way. She's a supervisory senior associate editor at The Atlantic. She lives in Baltimore. And today she published her thoughts in an article called Baltimore Lost, More Than a Bridge. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
It's hard. I can't imagine what kind of day it's been for you, for the people you know, just the city itself.
Yeah, it's been really strange, especially, you know, we all woke up to this news. I wake up every morning to WYPR, our local NPR affiliate, and 6:30 in the morning, the first thing you hear is that the bridge has collapsed, and it was quite shocking. And there wasn't a lot of information available early in the day, so I was texting a lot of my friends, just making sure that everybody had not, in fact, been on the bridge at 1:30 in the morning.
Yeah. And just the images. I mean, I was explaining I was up because of the time change. I was up when the first images started to appear on social media. And the first time you see them, you can't really comprehend that what you're watching is actually real.
It looks sped up. It's incredible how quickly something that big can just disintegrate.
For those who don't know anything about the Francis Scott Key Bridge, just how important an artery is it for the city?
It's hugely important. So Baltimore, for anybody who doesn't know the geography, is kind of hugging its main waterways. It's a port city. It's historically been defined by shipping. Shipping is still a huge industry here. So this is really the heart of the city. And there are three roadways that go across all of the water. One of them is the bridge. Two others are tunnels. The bridge had the lowest amount of traffic on any given day, but it was really important as a commuter artery. You know, everybody who lives in the suburbs around the city uses the Baltimore Beltway, 695, to get to work in the morning. And also, it's the only way to get hazardous materials across the harbor or across that section of the Patapsco River. So it's going to be a huge impact for trucking. Trucks are going to have to go all the way around the city in the other direction.
Yeah, I guess the entire focus today, I was listening to a bit of the NTSB report and so on, that everything today was really about hoping against hope that some of those who were still unaccounted for would be found.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's what I've been thinking about all day. I keep thinking about how Baltimore, if you haven't been here, is kind of notorious for its potholes. It's a regular topic of conversation around among everybody who drives here. And it sounds like the people who were working on the bridge were fixing potholes, and just this idea that they were doing this service that keeps the city running and ended up being sort of betrayed by the very structure that they were helping to keep strong is really sad. And it's been really a sad day.
Yeah, I think when I was first watching the images, I thought, I you know, it's 1:30 in the morning local time. I don't know how many people could be on that bridge at that time. And then word today that, of course, there had been a May Day call, that there'd been some warning, some, not much, but some warning. I mean, you just think about the possibilities, whether if this had happened without the warning, if this had happened at another time of day, it kind of boggles the mind.
Yeah, I've been also thinking a lot about what if this had happened at rush hour, because Baltimore is incredibly congested at rush hour. It's like we said, it's a huge commuter artery, and it just could have been even worse of a disaster than it already is, it's already a horrible disaster. Just there was a potential for so much loss of life.
I think I've lived in cities. I grew up in Montreal, which is another port city with bridges. You know, you often cross those bridges. You often look at the port activity and the ship activity. And you don't often, I mean, sometimes you think about what might happen, but you don't often think about what might happen. Is that something that's ever been a concern in Baltimore, just given the size of these container ships now and the infrastructure that existed around that port?
It's not something that I've ever thought about living here. Generally, the infrastructure in Baltimore People who live here know that there are some improvements that need to be made, but I've not felt unsafe going over a bridge here. I mean, it's usually when I'm crossing any one of the ways that bring you up to the city, it's more of a point of pride than of fear, because Baltimore does have this identity that's so tied to the water, so tied to shipping, so tied to labor. And it kind of makes my heart swell every time I approach the city and see the bridge and the tunnels, entrances, and the ships going in and out. It's really just, this is my city working hard, and these are all my neighbors working hard together.
Yeah. I was watching people. Obviously, there have been videos of it posted today of people on the bridge as it was. And it's a long one. I mean, I didn't realize it's a really long span.
It is, yeah. The whole bridge is 1.6 miles across, and it was just the main span of it that fell. Maryland actually has a lot of long bridges. There's one that goes over the Chesapeake farther out east. And it's sort of just a daily part of life, like the Chesapeake Bay is so integral to life in Maryland and in this part of the country, and water is everywhere. You're crossing water all the time.
The impact on the city. I know that the president talked about it today too. You mentioned what an important part. I mean, in certain parts of the world, ports have sort of lost their luster, but I mean, it's still a very active port and a very important part of the city's economy.
Absolutely. Transportation, along with utilities, employs something like 10% of the city right now. So that's a huge chunk. And I think the Port of Baltimore is number one in cars and light trucks for the nation right now. So I am not by any means an expert in supply chain logistics, but I can only imagine that there's going to be serious impacts.
Right. And at this point, Tom, I guess it's just uncertainty, right? We don't know what lies ahead. In fact, the investigation hasn't even really started.
We haven't gotten a ton of information from either the city or state government or the federal government about timing for reopening the port, finishing the investigation, rebuilding the bridge. But I think this is going to be a very long haul process. And Maryland's governor has already spoken about how, this is a project that is going to take a long time. Bridges are really hard to build, and this one was so tied into the flow of people and goods in and around the city that it's going to be really hard to replace.
Rachel Gutman-Wey is with us this half hour. She is in Baltimore. That's the place she calls home. She's written an article today for The Atlantic where she's a supervisory senior associate editor called Baltimore Has Lost More Than a Bridge. And we're looking into that aspect of it tonight. Rachel, Baltimore, it feels like has had hard knocks over time. And I imagine people will use the word resilience a lot in the next little while. But this is a tough one for a city that didn't need this sort of tragedy at this time of year.
Absolutely. I mean, I think resilience is exactly the right word. Baltimore is used to being resilient because it has to be. It's a city that is beautiful and charming and full of incredible people and incredible culture, but it also has a lot of problems. The infrastructure has problems. We've had multiple city administrations that have been corrupt in recent decades. We have had a state that has held back funding to fix our infrastructure. We have a lot of poverty. We have a murder rate that is dropping, but still much higher than it should be. Just last year, we had a major shooting, I believe not that far from the water. And each time the city comes back, it's full of people that are used to finding humor and creative solutions in the challenges that they face.
Yeah, you were saying in the article that your husband, who works at Johns Hopkins, who was his completing PhD at Johns Hopkins, sent you a photo of that area with the bridge gone. And wow, it just, I mean, I think every time I go to New York, you look up and the Twin Towers aren't there, and it's very different, obviously. But sometimes these massive pieces of infrastructure become, a living part of the city, and when they're gone, you suddenly realize just how much of the landscape they dominated.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the bridge was such a symbol of Baltimore's history and current status as a port city. I mentioned earlier that there are three roadways that get you through the major waterways around Baltimore. Two of them are tunnels. So the Key Bridge was the only one that you could see. And it was visible from a lot of other landmarks in the city. You can see it from Fort McHenry, which is where Francis Scott Key wrote the verses that would become the Star Spangled Banner. You can see it from this really funny pagoda that we have in one of our parks that's just sort of a local city icon. You can see it from Hopkins. You can see it from it itself is such an integral symbol of the city, and also you can see it from all these other really important landmarks. I know that there was another local reporter who was talking to a dock worker today who said that seeing Baltimore without the Key Bridge was like seeing the New York skyline after 9/11 without the Twin Towers.
Yeah. There were a lot of nice words coming out today about rebuilding and rebuilding fast and so on. I guess as someone who lives there, what are you looking for in the next little while?
I'm hopeful that we don't see, huge problems for people getting where they need to go on a daily basis. I hope that the bridge can be rebuilt strong, resilient, just like the city that it stands for. I know that there have been sort of a lot of discussions today about whether the bridge was properly protected from collisions and whatnot. And I'm not an engineer, so I can't answer that. But hopefully, once the bridge is rebuilt, it will be unlikely, if not impossible, that something like this could happen again.
Yeah. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Devastating. It's been a structure that's been in the Baltimore area for over 50 years or so, I understand. And now it's gone, you know.
Yeah, folks in Baltimore waking up this morning to a giant gap in the skyline, or at least in part of the skyline there, as a bridge was struck by a container ship last night and collapsed in a matter of seconds. I don't know if you've seen the video, but it is hard to believe that you're watching something happen in real time as it unfolds. There are many more questions tonight. We continue our coverage of that disaster in Baltimore. It all happened around 1:30 a.m. local time. Here's what we do know at this point. The 199-meter cargo ship, the Dalley, had set sail from the port of Baltimore at about 12:45 a.m., beginning a 27-day journey to the port city of Colombo in Sri Lanka. It's a long journey. It's owned by a company in Singapore, sails under the Singaporean flag. It was chartered to shipping giant Maersk. But just a little more than half an hour into that voyage at 1:24 a.m., according to reports, the ship's lights start to flicker for the first time. And just 4 minutes later, it collides with the bridge structure, causing it to collapse in seconds, plunging into the Patapsco River. It's reported that the ship was traveling at about 8 knots or about 15 kilometers an hour when the collision took place. U.S. President Joe Biden today praised the actions of the ship's captain, who sent a he sent a dis or they sent a distress signal to land that allowed bridge officials those critical moments to clear the bridge, mostly because we know some people are missing tonight before its collapse.
Personnel on board the ship were able to alert the Maryland Department of Transportation that they had lost control of their vessel, as you all know and reported. As a result, local authorities were able to close the bridge to traffic before the bridge was struck, which undoubtedly saved lives.
Indeed, six people, part of a crew filling potholes on the bridge, could not be found. Tonight, the Coast Guard has called off that search and rescue operation that stretched throughout the day. They will continue a search and recovery operation first thing tomorrow morning. During a press conference at the site of the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse this afternoon, U.S. NTSB Chair Jennifer Hammondi says the bulk of the investigation will begin or would begin after that search and rescue effort was complete.
We chose not to board the vessel today to allow some time for the search and recovery, which we did not want to interfere with.
Indeed. So what could have gone wrong with that ship? It's relatively new, built in South Korea in 2015. ABC reporter Terry Moran reveals that it did have a bit of a checkered past.
ABC News has obtained records showing the Dolly, built in 2015, had at least two documented issues in the past. A June 2023 inspection found a deficiency for propulsion and auxiliary machinery concerning gauges, thermometers, etc. And in 2016, after the ship was involved in a previous crash in Belgium, inspectors issued a deficiency for structural conditions concerning hull damage impairing seaworthiness.
But the most recent inspection, apparently, for the Dali was conducted by the U.S. Coast Guard in New York last September. And according to Aquasis data, the standard examination didn't identify any deficiencies. Someone who knows a lot about this and has been asked to talk about it a lot today is Sal Marcogliano, who's a professor at Campbell University. He's host of the What is Going On with Shipping show on YouTube, where you can see some really insightful analysis about what may have unfolded in Baltimore in the early hours this morning. Sal, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thanks for having me.
I know you've been talking about this a lot today, but perhaps to go over again what you understand unfolded, because everything seemed to start okay as it left port around 12:45 and it was being accompanied by those tugs. So far, so good. And then all of a sudden, it starts to go wrong.
Yeah, and it was pretty fast. I mean, when the ship dropped power, and you see that in the videos and the images out on this, the worst feeling for a merchant mariner is to be on a ship and have silence, and that's what they experienced. Everything got quiet. And when that happens, that means the propeller's not spinning, the rudder's not being answered, and you're basically on a ride of a 100,000-ton vessel without any control. So it's obviously a very scary situation to find yourself in. They got power back up. The question is, what power came back up? Was it an emergency diesel generator that came online to power lights, or was it the main propulsion system? That we don't know. We know the ship belched black smoke out. That could be the emergency generator coming on, could be the main engine coming back on. They could be trying to back down. We're just not 100% sure, but what we do know is that the ship's pilot, who had embarked the vessel to help pilot the ship out of the channel, was able to send out that warning. They did drop the port anchor, but at that speed and that large of a vessel, dropping an anchor that fast is just not going to slow them down.
Yeah. So just so listeners understand, there was a pilot who would have known on board to help the captain, who would have known that area inside out, right?
That's right. Remember, there were two pilots. There was a senior pilot and a pilot in training, we believe, to be on board. And that's standard in ports around the world. You would embark pilots to assist the ship's master in navigating the vessel. But ultimately, it is the ship's master who is responsible for the safe navigation of the vessel.
Tell me about what you think could have gone wrong, the series of events, because, again, as you mentioned, it happened all very quickly. I think the first time we see the lights flicker is around 1:24, and by 1:28, the collision has happened.
Right. I mean, you don't have a lot of time, and that's the margins that we operate usually in the maritime industry, unfortunately. There's very little room for error. And, you know, once that power goes off, if you do not have control of the ship's propulsion, to be able to turn the propeller, and more importantly, be able to turn the rudder, then you're at the forces of inertia, wind, current. And what we saw was the ship began to move south out of the channel, probably pushed by wind and current, could have had the propeller or the rudder kicked over just a little bit. And so they were not able to steer and maneuver. And unfortunately, the bridge, which was built about 50 years ago, 47 years ago on March 23rd, was not really designed with safety in mind of a ship the size of the Dali, because there were very few ships in 1977 that were rolling around that size. So a lot of the protections for the pilings for the bridge were just not sufficient to stop a vessel of that size once it hit it.
Right. And when we look at this is a relatively new ship, and I think people who don't know much about the industry would be surprised to think or to understand that a ship built 9 years ago could have that kind of a catastrophic failure. I mean, obviously, where it happened and when it happened was as bad as it could be. I understand it happens elsewhere and everything's okay, but a ship that new to have this kind of failure seems surprising for someone who doesn't study this stuff much.
Well, I mean, you could have anything. I mean, when you see a situation like this, it could be one of three things. It could be a mechanical issue. Was there a problem with the engine? Was there a fuel issue? Is it an electrical issue? Did they blow out a main board on the vessel? Or was it a human issue where someone did something incorrectly that led to the loss of power on the vessel? You know, if that takes place a minute earlier or a minute later, they missed that piling of the bridge, and we may not even be talking about it. We may just have a vessel that's aground or just sitting there in a channel waiting to happen. And unfortunately, one of the things we have seen is some instances over the past few years with ships having a loss of power because of, for example, contaminated fuel or improper fuel being loaded on board, and there's not a lot of margin once you lose propulsion. There's not really a redundant backup system on the ship to stop it, and the ship this size takes miles to stop.
Right. There would have been, I suspect that there would have been tests carried out before it left, that it was seaworthy and ready to go, right?
Right. Before a ship would ever depart, the ship and down the engine room and up on the bridge would do a series of checks. They would make sure the rudder answers. They would actually put the engine ahead in the stern. The ship underwent an inspection by the U.S. Coast Guard in September when it came into New York. But, you know, when the ship arrived just for this last trip, there wasn't any sort of inspection. It's not done on a consistent basis. They're done on a kind of rotation. And this is a very low priority mission for the U.S. Coast Guard to really inspect foreign vessels that come in. We have the right under what's called a port state authority to inspect foreign vessels. But that's largely to ensure that they're meeting pollution and life safety provisions. If they had mechanical issues or engine issues, then, you know, you would expect that to be presented by the ship's captain to the pilot. We don't know what the pilot was told about the situation of the vessel. Obviously, the pilot assumed the vessel to be in good working order, or else he or she wouldn't have taken it off the dock, and they would not have released the tugs so that they can proceed unaccompanied through the bridges.
Yeah, I'll text her because, of course, we're out here on the West Coast, and Vancouver has its share of shipping underneath bridges, and, of course, tugs are a very common sight. So it let the tugs go, which is common, but it could have kept them. Is that right?
Well, there's an issue about that. The tugs would have to be requested by the ship's owner, and that's a cost. And so there's always that issue about, you know, because of the fact that we move so much cargo so quickly, the volume and velocity of the world's trade is such that ships don't remain in port very long. They need to come off the berth. There are a finite amount of tugs in a port. And so, you know, using tugs for escorting a ship through the channel, for example, would take those tugs away from perhaps moving other ships on or off the berth. So unless a ship really needs them, they will typically not do it. Or if they're required to by the port, for example, if the Port of Baltimore tomorrow says you have to have tugs with you all the time, well, then ship owners and ship companies may take their ships to other ports and not have to pay that cost.
Right. I mean, therein lies a question that I don't think has come up much today, and I'm sure will come up in the future, is just the whole idea of shipping and how it works and how safe it is in these particular areas, especially given the obvious sensitivities of this bridge structure as well. What's your best guess then? I was watching your YouTube video earlier where you sort of lined up the video and so on. What's your best guess then about what might have gone so wrong so fast?
Well, I mean, again, I tend to lean toward the side that this is a fuel issue, that something caused them to lose propulsion in the vessel because the ship went dark and then came back up. That assumes that the emergency generators came back up, and then maybe they tried to switch back over to the main propulsion, and that caused the power to trip back off again. It's obviously a mechanical issue of some kind that caused this. But, you know, the issue with shipping is it's very complicated. I try to, you know, tell people, you take a ship like the Dolly. This is a ship that's owned by a Singapore company. It's flagged in Singapore. It's operating for a Danish company. The crew is Indian. The insurance for the cargo is British. The classification of the ship is Japanese. It's in a U.S. port, but the port is controlled by the city of Baltimore. The waters are controlled by the Coast Guard and the Army Corps of Engineers. You just get the idea of the complexity that is international shipping.
Direct to my team, move heaven and earth to reopen the port and rebuild the bridge as soon as humanly possible. And we're going to work hand in hand with the support of Maryland to support Maryland and whatever they ask for.
President Joe Biden there, who will be heading to Baltimore soon, it's reported. With me this half hour is Sal Mercogliano. He is the host of the What's Going On with Shipping show on YouTube. He's been talking a lot today about this bridge strike and collapse in Baltimore, the Francis Scott Key Bridge. It's about 2.63 kilometers long. It's one of the biggest bridges of its kind in the world, and it collapsed within seconds after being struck by a huge container ship called the Dali at about 1:30 in the morning this morning. Sal, I mean, I was obviously a lot has been made today about other strikes in the past. This is certainly not the first time this has happened, but I think people might be a bit surprised just to see that there isn't much room for error if things were to go. I mean, that's often the case in transportation, but there isn't a lot of wiggle room when something like this goes wrong.
No, there isn't. I mean, you know, people drive up and down the road and at 55 miles an hour with nothing between them but a 16th of an inch of yellow paint, you know, and so there tends to be very thin margins at times. And when everything's working, it's working just fine. But, you know, it's that one small mistake. And, you know, one of the things that we will be looking at in this is, you know, what are things like could have an inspection of the vessel have discovered some problems? You know, in the United States, it's the U.S. Coast Guard that does our port state control. But that's a very low priority mission for the U.S. Coast Guard. They have a lot of other ones, and so they don't devote probably anywhere near enough resources and personnel to this. So should there be better protection or better inspection of vessels regarding this? Again, there are a lot of ports right now that are having discussions about maybe we need to change rules for having tugs on standby. There's no guarantee that even if they had tugs, you know, with this vessel, that it could have prevented this from happening. You know, the ship was not operating at an excessive speed. 8 knots is about normal, about 10 miles an hour. You don't want to go too slow because then you don't have good rudder control. You don't want to go too fast because you may get into trouble. And, you know, everything seemed to be operating within the parameters. They just had a ship depart just prior to this. This is fairly normal for ships to go out at this time of night and then new ships come in the morning. So, you know, Baltimore is a busy port. There's a lot going on. It's not a huge port for the United States, but it's a major port in terms of a variety of different commodities that go in and out.
Yeah, and I suppose people were also surprised. I know you're not an engineer, but people were surprised by the fact that with that many ships going underneath, back and forth underneath that bridge, that it was that close to having this kind of a collapse, right? I mean, I think engineers have been saying today, listen, you have a ship that size, even going 8 knots, take out one of the two main supports of that bridge. There's not many different ways you could have built that bridge now, but I think people would be surprised to see with that much traffic coming out of the Port of Baltimore, that the bridge itself was so vulnerable.
Well, I mean, it goes back to the issue of investing in infrastructure. You know, that ship, the bridge when it was built 50 years ago was probably, you know, meeting the criteria for vessels of that size, but ships have gotten so much bigger, especially over the last 20 years. And, you know, Dali, which is a huge vessel in terms of container ships, is not that big. There's a lot bigger versions of ships like her that's out there. And, you know, do you need to put barriers, you know, between the pilings of the vessel and the channel so that the ship would hit these barriers vice? Because what actually happened here, we saw, is the ship actually hit the main piling and the superstructure, the bow and the containers, actually knocked the support out from the bridge. And again, you know, that much tonnage hitting anything, it's almost going to be impossible to prevent that from happening. I'm not even sure if you can build structures that would prevent a ship like the Dali from actually busting through and potentially getting at it. But again, this is reassessments need to be done continually on infrastructure and what needs to be done to keep them safe.
Right. And as you pointed out, shipping is a business that operates on speed, right? I mean, there is a lot of pressure on those companies to be moving around quickly.
It is. And, you know, one of the things we're seeing is a lot of pressure on the supply chain right now. This ship was leaving the Port of Baltimore. It was going to Sri Lanka. It was heading down to the Panama Canal. It was going to cross the Pacific. Normally, a ship like this would have gone through the Mediterranean, through the Suez, out the Red Sea, but they can't do that now because of the Houthis. So instead, this ship has to go a different route. And so, you know, we're seeing a lot of forces acting on the global supply chain. And what we see is when an incident like this happens, it's just more and more pressure. Now cargo is going to have to be diverted. You're going to have to move cargo. The containers that would normally go into Baltimore will have to go because you can't get to two of the main terminals into Baltimore. A massive amount of cars that are imported and exported out of the United States will have to go to the ports. And probably most significantly, a large percentage of the coal exports that come out of Baltimore now will not be able to go because there is just not facilities in any other port up and down the East Coast to take that coal. Plus, you would have to rail it that distance.
Yeah. I suppose people who live in cities that look a bit like what they're watching in Baltimore should be asking themselves, I mean, it happened in Baltimore. It feels like it. It's happened elsewhere before. It feels like it could have happened anywhere. It just happened to happen there.
Let's not forget, we just had a ship catch fire in the St. Lawrence. That could have easily have turned into a situation. You know, in Vancouver, you witnessed this when infrastructure was hit with the Fraser River flooding. So, I mean, we see how, you know, vulnerable, you know, just a few railway bridges are to get into Vancouver from the plains, and what happens when they're closed. This tends to happen. We don't have a lot of redundancy in some areas, and Baltimore is a cul-de-sac. You know, once you shut the Patapsco River, there's no other way into the port, and at least not through the deep channel. And so what we're seeing right now is the beginning of a salvage. One of the things I'm hoping is taking place is we finished up the rescue operation. We're in a recovery operation now. But salvage assets will have to be moved into this area. The ship is going to have to be moved. That's going to be done safely for fear it's been damaged. You don't want more of an accident than what you already have. And then you're going to have to clear the channel between the two pilings where the bridge stood to be able to open up the main shipping channel.
Yeah, I suppose the last, the fact that the captain managed to signal, or someone managed to signal the alarm, will be the saving grace of what happened last night.
Yeah, and you know, 2 years ago, there was an incident in Baltimore where the Ever Forward was coming out, and that ship grounded in the channel just past the Bay Bridge. And in that case, it was a pilot error. The pilot was distracted. But here we see a stellar performance by a Bay pilot, and he or she did everything they could to not just try to avoid hitting the bridge, but to alert people. And, you know, if you watch the replay of the AIS, the transponders, one of the things you see is how fast Coast Guard and rescue boats came to that area very quickly. When people went into the water to help stabilize the situation and prevent any further loss of life.
Sal, I appreciate your time tonight. I know you've had a busy day.
Happy to talk to you and to your listeners.
We continue our coverage tonight of the disaster in Baltimore and the many questions that are out there this evening about what went so terribly wrong just before 1:30 a.m. local time this morning. The 199-meter cargo ship, the Dali, had set sail from the port of Baltimore at about 12:45, beginning a 27-day journey to Sri Lanka. It's owned by a company in Singapore. Sails under the Singaporean flag, was chartered to the shipping giant Maersk. But just a little more than half an hour into that voyage, at about 1:24 a.m., the ship's lights start to flicker for the first time. It's believed that was the ship having some sort of catastrophic loss of power. It did come back a little bit at one point, but we don't know to what extent. Just 4 minutes after that, it collides with the bridge structure, causing it to collapse in just seconds, plunging it into the river below. It's reported that the ship was traveling at about 8 knots, about 15 kilometers an hour, when the collision took place. Two people were rescued. 6 people were missing tonight. The search for them has been called off. They are presumed dead. What happened? What happened with the ship? Ship expert Captain Michael Byrne says a loss of power often means a loss of control.
If a ship loses propulsion and steering, then it's really at the mercy of the wind and the current, and will go where they kind of send it.
But what about the bridge? It was built back in 1977. Construction started in 1972. How did it collapse so quickly? Maryland Governor Wes Moore said at a news conference that the bridge was up to code. The ship appeared to have hit a main concrete pier, which rests on soil underwater and is part of the foundation. One expert quoted today said that it is extremely unusual for a bridge to collapse due to a ship impact. But in this case, the bridge was supported at 2 points, and the Dali collided apparently with one of those two. Needless to say, as the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board begins this investigation, the head of the NTSB, Jennifer Hammendi, says they'll be looking at the bridge structure.
Part of our investigation will be how was this bridge constructed? It will look at the structure itself. Should there be any sort of safety improvements? All that will be part of our investigation. We go very broad in our investigation.
Joining me now is Robert Dowell. He's an associate professor of structural engineering at San Diego State University. Robert, thanks for your time tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Perhaps just your initial reaction to seeing that video?
Yeah, I watched the video of the impact about five times before I fully understood what happened and why the structure collapsed. One thing that was clear is that there was no bumper around the pier to protect it. You normally, if it's next to a major shipping channel, the pier would have a bumper around it to prevent any actual impact, direct impact on, into the structure, the foundation.
Right. I mean, I guess given the size of the ship, even though it was traveling, I mean, 15 kilometers an hour doesn't seem fast to someone who might be driving a car, but it's pretty fast for a ship of that size. And it looked like it took a pretty, I mean, it went in directly. I guess looking, from your point of view, did the bridge stand a chance?
Well, if the pier was a different type of pier, again, watching the video, I'm not that familiar with the bridge, but zooming in and looking at the pier and at photos later, it's clear that the pier was not a solid reinforced concrete column or pier structure. That's what's supporting the two ends of the main span there. It had like four different sort of slender members coming up. And when the ship impacted, it knocked out, you can see it knocked out one of those four vertical members as part of the one pier that supports the structure, the axial load. And as soon as that one of the four members sticking up fell down, the other ones were suddenly overloaded and they collapsed. And then it was a sequential event, a chain reaction that caused the whole main span to drop. If you lose a pier, to answer your question more directly, no bridge is designed to support two spans without one of the main piers. So any bridge type will collapse if you lose the vertical support member at the end.
Yeah. In this case, I think one of the things that's been so, and I watched it many times as well, last night trying to figure out what was happening, was the speed.
Yeah.
It was the speed with which it happened. It was almost, it looked like something out of a disaster movie. It happened so quickly. I'd never seen anything that big collapse that fast.
Well, it was just falling with gravity, just like dropping a rock. It was falling that fast. Once you remove the support, it was literally just free fall is what you saw from one side to the other.
Did it surprise you? I mean, I think one of the questions that's come up often tonight, needless to say, the Port of Baltimore is a very busy one, and many shipping containers have navigated that channel underneath that bridge with no problem at all. I think what was surprising perhaps to people who don't follow this closely was that it just took that one ship with one issue, and then the whole thing fell apart. I mean, the fact that there was no redundancy there at all, if this were to happen.
Yeah, that's true. And again, a big reinforced concrete pier that's maybe 20 feet across, even if that larger container ship hit it, it might get moved out of position 2 or 3 inches, but it might still stay. Whereas this was a fragile design of that vertical pier. So there are two issues that I see. It's that, and no massive bumper around the whole pier, which I would think is required. If you go and look at the big bridges in California, they all have these, at least ones that where a shipping a ship with containers or containers. Sorry.
Yeah, I know what you're getting at. Yeah,
there,
those big ships, yeah.
On it, yeah, that might run into it. That's they always have these large bumper systems around it so that you can't have direct impact, especially by the main shipping channel. Maybe at the shallower waters, that's not required because the ship can't impact the other piers.
Now, the construction of this bridge began in 1972. It was completed in 1977. That's not excessively old by bridge standards, but it was also, it sort of predates these mega ships that we see now. And perhaps the requirement wasn't there when it was built. Perhaps it was up to code, but perhaps it was standard when it was built, and it is no longer designed to withstand the kinds of ships that we're seeing these days.
Well, I mean, if you go look at the Golden Gate Bridge, it's like a 1932 bridge, and it has a massive bumper around the main pier that's mm-hmm. in the water there. So, and that's many years before the 1970s. So
it's,
I think, standard practice to protect those piers against major ships, heavy ships.
We often talk about failing infrastructure. I mean, one could only, I guess we'll find out, but you could only assume the reason that it wasn't done was cost.
It is pretty expensive. I don't know the amounts, but you're right. We're looking at it later. There was a little bump around it, but obviously not large enough. You have a big ship like that that comes in. It's high above where it looked like the bumper system was, and then it just had to knock out one part of that pier, and then the rest is very clear what happened.
Yeah. I suppose this will force some sort of reckoning around these things. It's certainly not the first time it's happened. We see it happen, no, I wouldn't say regularly, but it's not uncommon. No. If you look back at the history of ship strikes against bridges causing mayhem and disaster, it's not a once in a century event. It happens more than that. But is the system, I mean, are new bridges any better protected? Are we getting better? Because it feels like when you look at something like what happened last night, just the video, you think, well, of course that might happen one day. And wow, it only takes that for everything just to collapse.
Yeah. And then it's not just the collapse of the bridge, but then the whole port is closed. You can't get ships past it because the bridge itself is in the way. So it's a major, economic and life disaster and everything.
Robert, perhaps just, there's been a lot of talk today. President Joe Biden was saying, we're going to try and rebuild this quickly. What's your sense of how quickly you can replace what's been lost?
They can probably remove it pretty quickly, but for a new bridge of that size, that would probably take several years to replace.
Right. And in the meantime, I guess that's causes. I mean, it's obviously a huge issue for the city of Baltimore itself, if you live there. Any last thoughts then on what we should take away from this? I know we don't know everything there is to know about this yet, but when it comes to this very obvious issue between bridges and big ships, of which, right around the world we see that, what should we walk away with from this one at this point, do you think?
I think the lesson here is that we always provide large bumper systems for the main shipping channels, for all the piers that are in the water. Don't allow the ships to impact the main structure at all. Have it impact something else that's adjacent to it.
Yeah. Well, Robert, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's our biggest moneymaker in the whole state, right there, the Port of Baltimore. And now your moneymaker is shut down. So what's going to make or break the state is how fast they get that shipping lane open so they can open back up.
Yeah, if you didn't know much about the Port of Baltimore, and I don't imagine many Canadian listeners would follow much about the Port of Baltimore other than maybe having seen it in The Wire many years ago, it is a really important port, not necessarily in terms of its volume, but in terms of what it ships out. I just want to quickly share a text first. One texter says that the ship had lost power 1 minute later after it had passed under the bridge. We wouldn't be talking about this. Wrong place at the wrong time. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I think what we're going to discover here is, like so many accident investigations, whether it be planes or trains, or in this case, ships, that it is a culmination of terrible things all happening at once. Ultimately, they'll find fault somewhere, somehow. But that ultimately it all happened. It was a culmination of terrible things happening all at once, right? And that's what we witnessed last night. But the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge could have a real economic impact, effectively shutting down the nation's busiest port, if you didn't know this, for cars and light trucks in the U.S. It's the ninth busiest port overall. And it's going to be closed at this point indefinitely. Shortly after the bridge collapsed, the Port of Baltimore suspended vessel traffic until, quote, further notice, according to its website. Last year, the Port of Baltimore alone handled 850,000 cars and light trucks, more than any other U.S. port. GM, Ford, Stellantis, they all use that port mostly for exporting vehicles manufactured in North America to Europe. And of course, you can imagine how integrated the vehicle manufacturing sector is. So there is a Canadian element to this as well. The facility also handled 1.3 million tons of farm and construction machinery, the most of any U.S. port. So what impact will this have on that and on supply chains broadly? Jason Miller is the interim chair of the Department of Supply Chain Management at Michigan State University. Jason, thanks for your time tonight.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
I don't think Baltimore is one of those ports we often talk about when we talk about major American ports, but it is an important one in more ways than one.
No, it is. It is. When we often focus on U.S. ports, we're thinking about, containerized trade. Baltimore is not that big of a container port, not that far away. The port of New York, New Jersey, swallows it quite easily. But Baltimore is a huge port for what we call roll-on, roll-off cargo. and that is heavily motor vehicles that are finished, construction equipment, and farm equipment.
Right. And these are all things that, if we know much about a Canada-US supply chain, this will have an impact across the border as well, because it's certainly auto is a very integrated industry.
No, it is. I mean, you know, the Ambassador Bridge here, I'm here in Michigan. It's like the second busiest, import-export location in the U.S. for motor vehicles. Probably if you combine import and export, it's likely the busiest. This is all interconnected in. Baltimore exports about $4 plus billion of finished vehicles, and imports a staggering $23 billion of finished vehicles. No, that's coming primarily from Germany, Mexico, Japan, and then the United Kingdom.
Right. So we will feel the impacts of this. We don't know how long the port is going to be shut for, but it's certainly shut now.
Yeah, it is. And there was just actually some reporting coming out that the port is basically closed indefinitely at the moment. So we do not have a good sense of when a reopening will take place.
You also mentioned farm equipment is another big one. And that is another industry that that Canadians will be familiar with.
No, it is. And this is the one sector where Baltimore really plays, I'd say kind of an outsized role in things. For example, if we look in 2023 in the United States, and believe it or not, this is how detailed the Census Bureau reports trade data for large agricultural tractors. Baltimore accounted for 53% of the 6,000 or so of those brought into the country. So over 3,000 large tractors came in through that port. And from the export side of things, roughly 6,000 left that port. And so you start thinking about it, that's 9,000 large pieces of farm equipment of just tractor type that we now have to think about, okay, where do we bring this stuff into and out of, especially assuming this could be a closure for, let's say, a month or more.
What will the trickle-down effects be then? Because we know this isn't the only issue facing the shipping industry around the world. There's the issues in the Red Sea. There's problems with the Suez Canal, problems with the Panama Canal, and so on.
So this will affect, I'd say, more that roll-on, roll-off type of cargo. From a containerized standpoint, Baltimore, you can reroute a lot of this to New York, New Jersey, or Norfolk, Virginia, and then if you include Charleston, South Carolina, as well as Savannah, Georgia. You can reroute the containerized trade with little issue and reposition the freight. The bigger challenge is going to be, what do you do with, hundreds of thousands of finished motor vehicles, tens of thousands of pieces of farm equipment and construction equipment that move through this port? That's where you're going to have more difficulty, just because there aren't quite as many alternatives. And where it really is jumping out to me is that farm equipment pieces, there's going to be challenges. We're all talking finished goods. It is important to note that Baltimore plays a disproportionate role in U.S. exports of coal. Mm-hmm. It's about 44% of bituminous coal exports leave that port. But also importing primary metals, so unwrought tin, unwrought aluminum, refined lead, and things of that sort. Baltimore, in some cases, accounts for 3/4 of U.S. imports of certain primary metals.
Right. So we mightn't see this impacted on the stores of your local mega mart or whatever, but we might see it impacted in, further up the supply chain.
No, exactly. I mean, for example, when we take a look and say, okay, Baltimore accounts for 76% of the imports of unwrought tin. Well, while we have to find a alternative port to bring tin into the United States, tin's used in a lot of different refined products eventually. And so we may start seeing some disruptions there if safety inventories get burnt down too much.
Yeah, and this is at a time, of course, where we're seeing some reshoring, right? We've tried to bring manufacturing back onto the continent, and this will deal a bit of a blow to that, at least temporarily.
Well, and unfortunately in the U.S., we've been in a manufacturing recession since about the late third, early fourth quarter of 2022. And possibly the only thing that has making this disruption a little bit less pronounced has been the fact, you know, manufacturing demand has been weak. Take farm equipment. We've seen commodity prices come down substantially over the past 6 months. Anytime farm commodities get less valuable, farmers are buying less equipment. So we were entering 2024, you know, I was expecting less production of farm equipment in the United States, just given less global demand and given less domestic demand. So the fact that this is playing out in that a weaker demand environment makes a disruption like this a little bit less impactful versus when we all can recall 2021, when we're in a very superheated demand environment and we were experiencing disruptions.
Right. A reminder, I guess, though, just how interconnected and how sensitive this whole supply chain system really is when one piece of it goes down.
No, it is. And especially, you know, when you start drilling down and you start identifying, okay, you know, 42% of cane sugar that the United States imports comes in through the Port of Baltimore. I don't know how difficult it will be to find different ports in which we bring in bulk cane sugar, but things like this, it may seem very easy, actually end up sometimes being quite difficult. Farm equipment's a great example. Somebody may think, well, we can just, you know, it rolls. You can just move it somewhere else and roll it onto a ship. And yeah, you still need infrastructure facilities to support those type of activities.
Jason, I guess we'll see just how long it takes them. I mean, I think everyone's keenly aware of how important it is to get this port back up and running. Thank you so much.
No, thanks. Thank you for having me.
Units responding to Press Alarm I-695, be advised, the entire Key Bridge has now collapsed into the water. The entire Key Bridge has now collapsed into the water. Proceed with caution. It's 152.
Yeah, Baltimore City Fire Dispatch early this morning, just after 1:30, after that the key bridge, as it's known, collapsed into the river below after being struck by a large container ship around 1:30 a.m. local time. We continue our coverage tonight. We've looked at this from many different angles this evening. Maryland's Governor Wes Moore says the operators of the ship issued a mayday call moments before the crash, allowing police to stop traffic. Unfortunately, six people as part of a road crew that was doing work on the bridge at the time fell into the water and are believed to be presumed dead. There was a search going on all day today. The collision happened around 1:30 a.m. local time, as I mentioned. Those living nearby described it this way.
It's unbelievable. I've been in this neighborhood 57 years. I remember when they started building that bridge and can't believe it's gone. It sounded like a big bash of thunder, and then just like I say, felt like an earthquake. The whole house vibrated, like my house was falling down.
Now, so far, the investigation, of course, is just beginning, but fingers are being pointed at what appears to have been a catastrophic power failure aboard the Dali. This is the cargo ship that hit the bridge. It was built in 2015, so it's relatively new. How could it have experienced such a catastrophic failure? James Mercante is a maritime lawyer and president of the New York Board of Pilot Commissioners, the state agency there responsible for regulating and licensing pilots. He joins me now. James, thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Good to make your acquaintance, Ben.
Well, I mean, just I suppose to start at the beginning, given where this container ship was coming from and where it was headed, it would have been piloted out of that port. Is that right?
Yeah, it would have been piloted out of that port because it was heading overseas, and ships that are engaged in, you know, foreign commerce are required to take a compulsory pilot, because the captains of these ships that come in may have no understanding of the local rocks, reefs, and shoals of a particular port. So they engage a pilot who's an expert in navigating ships in and out of their particular port. In this case, the Port of Baltimore, in our case, the Port of New York. And they have, skilled mariners trained to maneuver big ships in close quarter situations.
Right. So you wouldn't want anyone better at the helm in a situation even as awful as this one.
Yep. That's right. I mean, this pilot that was on board probably traversed that bridge in his career in daylight and at nighttime hours, you know, hundreds of times. They know what to do and when they have to do it. Unfortunately, you get ship malfunctions, and depending upon where it occurs, and you know the speed of the vessel and the proximity to, you know, the things like bridges, it becomes in extremis when you have a loss of propulsion or a loss of power or loss of steering, requiring a mayday call, which is a very, very in extremis call in the maritime community. When you hear a mayday, I mean, I think everyone knows that term, whether you're a mariner or not. And for a pilot to use that term, it was very bad.
Yeah, just from what you could glean from the video that we've seen, it appears as if the Dali loses power. We see the lights come back on briefly. It was obviously having some sort of catastrophic power issue. We just don't know the extent of it yet.
Right. You do see a huge puff of thick black smoke coming out of the ship's stacks, you know, right before impact. So you don't know if there was a fire in the engine room or power was restored temporarily, and that was the function of the engines just working in extremely fast in reverse or even fast forward to try to make a turn away from the bridge. Those are some of the potential options, either a fire or a very heavy maneuver astern or forward to get that type of smoke emanating from the stack like that.
Because as you were mentioning, the pilot would be keenly aware of what the distances were and what he was dealing with, or he or she was dealing with. They would have been under that bridge back and forth with a ship of that size many times in the past. What about the speed? Because I gather I've heard it was 8 knots. I'm not quite sure whether that would be considered fast or not.
You know, it's a pretty open area, so 8 knots is not a lot of speed, you know, for a ship of that size coming under a bridge. And remember, you have to have enough speed to maintain steerage way. If you're going any significantly slower than that, you're going to be subject to the wind and currents. And remember, these ships are carrying a lot of containers stacked high on deck, and they act as a sail, like a, you know, they call it sail area. So if there's any type of wind and current, you know, if you're crawling at a slow speed, especially with the currents that form under bridges, you know, at a slower speed, you'd risk, you know, not maintaining steerage way when you're transiting a bridge.
Yeah, in this case, for listeners to remember, this is a large and heavy ship. This is a 299-meter ship for Canadians. That's about 900 feet. Three football fields, right? That is a very big vessel.
It's a very big vessel, three football fields long and about a half a football field in width. So it's over 158 inches wide, which is a huge beam. It can carry, you know, like 10,000 containers. I don't know how many was carried at this time, but you could tell it was stacked pretty high, the containers on deck. And, you know, they're delivering cargo all around the world, and that's what keeps the wheels of commerce going. But nonetheless, it looked like a pretty large complement of containers, both on deck and below deck. I mean, you only see what's on deck, but there's thousands of containers below deck as well.
Yeah, which gives you a clear idea of just how little room to maneuver they would have had once things started to go wrong.
Yeah, because if you could picture, if that ship goes sideways, you know, that's three football fields in length. So it could be quite a task to go through that bridge sideways if it lost, you know, propulsion and was just subject to the currents and the winds. But here, my understanding is that they did deploy an anchor, but it's going to be tough to stop a ship that has momentum with an anchor or two because of the momentum. And it takes, you know, with the depth of water there, you know, it takes a while for that anchor to grab, if it grabs. I mean, when the ship's going around 7-8 knots and you drop anchor, the ship's still moving ahead and the anchor is still dropping down. So it takes time for that anchor to reach the bottom and then grab and stop a ship that's heavy. So that the dynamics and the forces are pretty extraordinary.
James Mercante is a maritime lawyer. He's also the head of the president of the New York Board of Pilot Commissioners, that state agency in New York responsible for regulating and licensing ship pilots. We're talking about, of course, the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore overnight after a container ship, about a 300-meter long container ship, collided with the bridge and took it down in a matter of seconds. So, James, as you were saying, I mean, they would have no doubt tried to do everything they could given this situation. They would have been keenly aware of what was about to happen if they couldn't steer. I mean, thankfully, they issued that Mayday call. They're being praised today for having had the foresight to do that.
Yeah, my understanding is also, Ben, that they reached out to the bridge tower and alerted the bridge tower that there was an imminent collision about to occur. That's why there was very, very few cars that had already been committed to go over the bridge. But yeah, these pilots are trained for years and years and years. I'm sure they were very skilled. They train, they do, just before they could even get a license to pilot, they got to pilot about 1,000, they got to command about 1,000 ships. There's no question in my mind that there wouldn't be any pilot error here, although, you know, that'll all be investigated. But because, again, this was a routine maneuver. This was an absolute routine maneuver. And at the 11th hour and 59th minute, you know, they lost power. And I imagine they were working feverishly to restore power. And look, we've had many loss of propulsion situations in New York Harbor. And oftentimes you're not in close proximity to a bridge or a hazard. And they drop, you know, that's what they do. They drop the anchor and they wait for it to be sorted out. There's also times where if you're underway and you can't, you know, stop and you're staring down into danger, that they drop anchor and they continue. While they continue in the engine room, remember, there's an engine room probably the size of a half a city block on this ship. And the engineers would be working feverishly to try to determine what caused the lack of propulsion, you know, whether it's a generator failure, clogged filters, faulty air valves, bad fuel. And, you know, they can get this thing started pretty quickly if it's not a major problem. And I'm sure they were, you know, working feverishly to get to the root of the problem. And, you know, there is the Voyage Data Recorder, which is the functional equivalent of the black box on an airplane that records all the communications on the bridge and the course and the speed. Whatever communications were taking place on that ship between the bridge of the ship and the engine room, the bridge of the ship and the bow where they were dropping the anchors, and the communications between the pilot and the captain, all that will be recorded and available to the investigators. They'll get to the bottom of what caused the propulsion failure and whether it was a lack of propulsion and steering. I mean, we don't even know if they had steering. If the ship went totally dark, like it looks like just either at impact or before impact, it looks like the ship goes totally dark. And if it goes totally dark like that, they may have had no steering and no propulsion. And then you're just a sitting duck.
Yeah, I suspect that like all these incidents, these horrific incidents, it will have been many things that went wrong, right? I mean, it's normally what we see, many things. What are some of the things that you'll be looking out for now? What would you like to know?
I'd like to hear the that's a good question. I'd like to hear the dialogue, the VDR, which eventually will be released because there'll be a major marine casualty investigation headed up by the NTSB and assisted by the Coast Guard. And eventually we will hear what happened on the bridge. So that's what I'd like to know as an attorney that handles, you know, major marine casualties, and I've handled many bridge strikes. You know, you want to know the course, the speed, the communications, how they lost power, why they lost power. You know, who was on duty in the engine room? Who was on watch on the bow when they dropped? Was there any delay in dropping the anchor? You know, was the crewman on the bow ready to drop anchor, or did they have to, you know, get him out of the galley or get him out of his room? You know, when you're getting underway like that, there should be a crewman on the bow. And so the question there also will be then that I'd like to know is how long it took to drop the anchor from when they realized they needed to drop the anchor. And that's going to be a very interesting answer to that question.
Who's liable here, ultimately?
Well, in admiralty law, you know, the ship itself is personified. So the ship is like a thing that can be sued. The pilots themselves rarely, you know, get sued personally. But, you know, if it's a ship problem, then it's going to be a ship legal problem as well. But, you know, that's, you know, going to all be sorted out. I mean, you know, I don't think anyone's going to blame the bridge. The area is pretty well lit up. So, if it's a mechanical failure, mechanical malfunction, loss of steering, loss of propulsion, then the ship's attorneys and their insurers will be dealing with that. You know, I'm sure trying their best to make things as right as they can. But this is, you know, one of those tremendous casualties where you have, you know, injuries, fatalities, bridge collapse. It's going to be a salvage operation, a removal of the bridge from the water. The commerce is coming to a halt. There's cruise ships that would be going in and out of that port. There's cargo that would be going in and out of that port that's delayed. So, you know, obviously the maintenance of that ship and the engine room is going to be very looked at very carefully. You know, it's going to be a textbook admiralty law case. That's for sure, Ben.
Yeah. Any final thoughts, James? I know for someone who's involved in this so intimately that watching this unfold last night and then seeing the aftermath today must resonate with you in a way that it doesn't for many others.
Well, you know, being a former mariner myself and a graduate of the United States Merchant Marine Academy, what resonates with me is, you know, I can even get choked up about it, but I just feel, look, obviously, for the families and the people who lost lives and injured, it's just terrible. But also for the pilot who was on board and in command of the navigation and not being able to wrestle control of the ship because of the propulsion issues, if that's what it ultimately was. But, you know, that this has to be tremendously traumatic for the pilot and the captain of that ship as well. There's no winners here. You know, there's a pilot that lives in Maryland who's got to go home tonight and face his family, face the media, listen to the news. And I'm sure he's tremendously traumatized. And it's a tragedy all around, bar none.
James, I really appreciate your time and your insight on this. Thank you.
You're welcome, Ben. Good questions. Thank you.
It wasn't a bad day to take a walk where I am today. The sun was kind of out, which is nice. It was a little chilly for this time of year. But spring is definitely here. And that's the time of year when many of us, after sort of hibernating for the winter, take a look around and start to think, maybe I won't just do a little bit of spring cleaning, but maybe I'll also update a few things. There's a few walls I've been staring at for the last 4, 5, 6 months that maybe need a little changing, maybe a renewal for the place we call home. It can be a bit of a daunting prospect these days with the cost of absolutely everything from material and labor, not to mention mortgages and rent and so on, up, and budgets obviously stretched a bit thin. But my next guest has made a career of helping people find the right recipe for those sorts of projects. Kenny Brain will be known to some of you for his time on season 2 of Global's Big Brother Canada, but he's also been a fixture on HGTV Canada for quite a few years now. He's a general contractor and carpenter from Grand Falls, Windsor in Newfoundland, and he's been a fixture alongside Courtney Wilson in Making It Home with Courtney and Kenny. Here's a bit of a taste of that show.
Let's go, team.
Let's do it.
Are you in there?
Scalpel, please.
This house needs so much work.
This is all completely rotted out.
How does this affect us and how do we move forward?
Every room is like pow, pow, beautiful.
It is gorgeous.
This is how you make a place a home.
Making It Home with Courtney and Kenny on HGTV.
Well, Kenny Brain's work has brought him right across Canada into the U.S. as well. We first spoke to him back in the fall of 2022, so we thought we'd check in with him again as the seasons change to get some advice on how to best bring some renewal to your home over the next while. Kenny Brain joins me now. Thanks for your time. Welcome back.
Ben, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I was thinking the last we spoke back in 2022, I mean, it felt like, you know, we talked a lot about supply chains and all the things that were impacting all of what you do. And all of a sudden, right after that, we bumped into this massive affordability crisis. And I'm wondering, that must have changed things a bit for you over the past 18 months or so.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, as of right now, from, you know, A to Z, everything has gotten more expensive. From the manufacturing, the harvesting of products to, you know, the land, the permits that you're building on to, you know, the nails, the lumber, the labor, absolutely everything right now is much more expensive. So in terms of like buying houses, building houses, it's affected everybody.
Yeah. And it must mean that I wonder what it means for your clients, whether people are more brave, less brave, or how they're approaching these big jobs. Because obviously, as one knows from watching your shows, you never know what you'll find once you start tearing stuff up, right?
100% it's affecting the decisions that they make. I mean, if you are, everybody goes into a renovation with, you know, bright eyes and bushy tails. But as the process goes along, you kind of have to make those hard decisions because, like you said, you open up, you don't know what you're going to find. If you, you know, open up, you find asbestos, you get an abatement. If you open up and you need to replace your ceiling joists, you know, you have to reframe your house kind of thing. So when it comes down to creativity and, you know, design style, sometimes things get cut. Like, are you going to put that pot filler in the wall? Because that's going to be a rough-in and a plumber and the fixtures. Or are you going to, you know, fix your leaky roof?
Yeah. But I guess through the pandemic, a lot of people began to see their homes kind of differently, right? And wanted differences. I mean, even just watching the last season of Making It Home, there was a lot of what we had just gone through was reflected in how people were treating what they wanted to see in their space.
Well, people are spending more time in their home than ever. So that's why they're really kind of making these decisions to make them reflect who they are and what they need. You know, take open concept space, for instance. Everybody kind of wanted that for the longest time. And I think with COVID and being trapped in the house, people are really starting to move towards individual spaces and kind of making those individual spaces definitive, whether that's a home office with a specific style or, you know, a powder room that's really funky and completely a departure from the rest of the house.
Yeah. I live in an open space and I can attest to this completely. It was wonderful before. And then we both had to start working in the same open space and it became a bit of a nightmare.
Exactly. I can hear you breathe. I do not want to hear you breathe.
I don't want to hear you talk ever again, kind of stuff. You know, that, needless to say, I talk for a living, right? So it got. Are you seeing the same thing right across the country? Is there any change, or even into the U.S.? Are we all sort of in the same boat right now?
I mean, I can't accurately speak onto the U.S. because when I was there, it was kind of the height of COVID, right? So mm-hmm. You're talking about supply chain issues and cost, and things were through the roof then. Since I've left, I'm more so based in Canada right now. So I can't really speak too much about Canada. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely affected everything here. Every single thing, from, like I said, from the harvesting of products to the end product that you have of your home, it's been effective.
When you look at this is the time of year where a lot of people sort of crawl out of hibernation, start looking around their surroundings and thinking, I wouldn't mind a change. What advice do you give them at this time of year, given the circumstances we've just been talking about, that everything feels just a little bit bigger, a little bit more expensive than it might have, you know, 3-4 years ago?
It's 100% step one before you do anything is have a plan. You know, what is your budget? What are your priorities with that budget? I think a lot of people go into renovations not really fully comprehending how long or how much money it's going to cost them. So if you're renovating, especially any kind of older home, you're definitely going to run into some unexpected bumps in the road. So that's just life. Expect it, plan for it, and your budget should reflect that with some sort of contingency. And, you know, when I say set priorities, I mean, what are your absolutes? If something should happen, and they probably will, what can you live without?
And you notice that. I mean, I notice a lot of it in a lot of your shows. There's a lot of DIY that must go on, because when you start ripping up floors, you find lots of awful stuff. I suppose that's a warning for the DIYers out there as well, especially these days when any mistake is going to cost you a bundle.
Absolutely. I mean, I get it. I truly do get it. You know, being proud of your space, wanting to do things with your own two hands and save a little bit of money, you know, do it yourself. I get that, but there are a lot of things that you can do without, you know, compromising the integrity of your home or, you know, putting yourself in danger. So, you know, please, if you are going to be opening up walls or, you know, changing rough-ins and plumbing and electricity, call a licensed contractor. You know, somebody if you vet it thoroughly, you have references, you've seen what they can do, what they don't do, and, you know, have similar communication styles. These are all super important to have kind of a seamless transition in what is probably going to be one of the most stressful things you've gone through.
Yeah. Tell me, I mean, I've seen the ones on the show, some pretty interesting looking reno jobs. What are some of the ones you bumped into over the years, just the DIYs that went completely wrong that you had to fix?
Oh my God. The list is honestly never ending. When, you know, using wooden showers, 2x4s, the electrical work when they've had to kind of fur out the wall and made it thicker, and they've just actually used wire to go right back into the outlet that was currently there instead of rewiring it, which is, and you could just see the burn marks around it. It was just waiting to catch fire kind of thing. The horror stories just go on and on and on.
Kenny Brain of HGTV is with us this half hour. We're talking, it's springtime. This is a lot of time. This is the time of year where many people sort of look around them, think, okay, my hibernation is done. Now it's time to fix this place because I've been sitting in it all winter and I'd like to make some changes. So we're trying to get some advice on where you should start. Kenny, when people sort of start with their homes, where do you find the inspiration usually begins? Because it seems to me that oftentimes the kitchen is kind of the template, but I don't know that to be true.
Well, you're kind of right there. I think you hit the nail on the head. It's usually the kitchen. It's where they spend historically where homeowners spend the most of their time. So that's where they're going to want to invest the most of their money. You know, that's where it's kind of tricky actually, because you would think there would be the most creativity in the kitchen because there's so many moving parts, right? Every single solitary trade is in your kitchen, from framers to electricians to plumbers, HVAC, millwork, you know, the works. It's going to be the biggest return on your investment of your house. So you'd think that's where creativity would kind of spark. However, because it is so expensive and it's usually towards the end of a renovation that you start making those decisions, I think that's actually where homeowners start to falter, because A, they're running out of money, and B, they don't want to alienate any kind of future buyers for their home by designing anything outside the box. So it's funny because the kitchen is where the money goes, and I think the kitchen is where people start. But towards the end of it, I also think that's where it starts to kind of taper and be a little bit, dare I say, boring?
Yeah, well, people want to err on the side of caution with the kitchen sometimes, right? That's part of the issue. It's funny you mentioned that, because I was thinking the same thing. Because our kitchen needs a little a little renovation. But I was thinking too that with the way the housing market is now, people are probably trying to be a little more conservative with things, because things aren't flying off the shelves they were 2 or 3 years ago. And you know, you don't want to alienate buyers by doing something a little off the wall.
Absolutely. But I mean, there's still lots of things that you can do without alienating buyers and, you know, just kind of like going along with what you see. And it's very hard not to be influenced by what you see online. Like I go back to like the millennial gray all the time,
right?
Because for so long, everybody was flipping and it was, you know, the color that was popular. You saw it on Pinterest, you saw it on TV, and that's what everybody was using. And it's kind of like, it's kind of hard to break out of the mold that you see when you're influenced by so much all the time. But at the same time, I'm a little excited by what I do see starting to come out, because that is starting to be a thing of the past. And thank goodness for that. You're starting to see a lot more color and you're starting to see a lot more expression. And, you know, that minimalist thing is starting to be a little bit more, you know, there's more character.
You know? Yeah. Did you get tired of that minimalist thing? Because I didn't grow up in a minimalist home at all. I grew up in kind of like an old triplex in Montreal that had more character than anything else. But yeah, I was always the minimalist thing. I mean, I could see why it appealed to people who were sort of buying and flipping or Airbnb-ing and so on, but it didn't have a lot of soul.
No, and I agree with you there. I didn't grow up with minimalist. I grew up with pictures and books, and my mom was really good with lighting and, you know, creating an ambiance. So our house was always full of character and warmth, and that influences you for, you know, what you like and what you don't like, obviously. But when I'm doing these for clients, I can't necessarily say, hey, what you want is wrong.
So no.
You kind of have to go along with it.
Yeah, one would think. But it's nice. So we're seeing more color come back now. We're going to see slightly different things, you think, in sort of 2024, 2025 than we've been watching over the past little while, at least.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think people are starting to experiment with textures. They're starting to, not be so afraid of moodier colors and browns and mauves and things like that and wallpapers and, displaying who you are and your life and where you've been is something you should be proud of. It should be incorporated into your style. It shouldn't be something that you stick into your closet and, collect dust. Put it out on display.
Yeah, kind of like tattoos in some weird way. Yeah, I mean,
Very true.
it's a big plunge. It's a big plunge. So tell me a bit about what you see coming up in the next little while. I gather we're going to see kind of a continuation of the same, and to some extent, but you're going to see things change a little bit. Plus, I guess people are just being a little more cautious these days, given the expense of everything. So if you're going to set forth into some kind of major job, whether you do it yourself or ask someone, hire someone else to do it, just be prepared to have a plan and maybe pay more than you thought you would.
Yeah,
Maybe.
exactly. Have a plan. Expect to pay more than what that plan is. So have a contingency, and be open to trusting your instinct. If you are gravitating towards something and that's not something that you necessarily see that's popular, do it. That's how style is created, and that's how trends are created. So just because you don't see it, pinned on your Pinterest board nonstop, doesn't mean you can't do it.
Do you think people should break away from that? I mean, social media has become so influential. We don't even go to restaurants until we've looked them up on Yelp, right? So I think we've become so impacted by what we see online. I mean, there's lots of great stuff out there, but sometimes we sort of get trapped in that same, that circular thing where you're kind of seeing the same stuff over and over again. So you convince yourself that that's the only way to go.
Absolutely. I mean, it's this catch 22, right? It's this vicious circle. How do you stoke the creative fire without kind of pulling from what you've been influenced from? Everybody's influenced by everything around them, from the people, their neighbors, their family, what they see on TV. So it's hard not to be influenced. And I'm not saying like do not look at the internet. That's impossible. What I'm saying is that like you don't have to have exactly what everybody else has, and you can also evolve what you do see. You know what I mean? Like if the modern farmhouse, that was a massive trend, coined, I think that term was coined in the New York Times in 2016, and it has done nothing but kind of grow. But we're seeing a little bit of a downwards trend on that in larger populated areas, but it's starting to evolve. Instead of like the bright white board and batten and the black trim windows, you're seeing more color infused into it. So it you don't necessarily have to not do what you see. It's just put your own personal spin on it.
Yeah, it'll be nice to see color come back a little bit more. Kenny, as always, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Ben, it has been a pleasure.
Now let's talk about walking this half hour. So I have one of these fitness trackers, right? I've had one for a while. I had a Fitbit for a while. Now I have an Apple Watch that I got as a gift. I'm not wearing it today, actually, so I actually don't know how many steps I took today. But most days I pay attention because they're kind of addictive that way. That's the whole point, right? There, you sort of think, I should really walk these extra steps. And in fact, I used to catch myself walking around our living room late at night. If I was at, say, 9,400 and something, I would keep walking till I got to 10,000, till I finally realized, why am I doing this? Because the exercise is obviously good for you. Getting out and moving is good for you. We know that. But do you need to get to 10,000 steps every single day? Are you really doing your body any good if you're walking around the living room at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night? Or are you just making sure you don't get a good night's sleep because you basically got your heart rate up again, right? But 10,000 steps a day has indeed become kind of the gold standard out there, right? It's the number that has sold many step counting devices and inspired a whole lot of sort of inter-office contests and so on. It's also the fodder for a whole lot of comedy. Have a listen.
It's not just selfies. We count our steps. I'm the worst. I've got a Fitbit. I know how many steps I've taken every day. How is that useful? I'll do anything to get my 10,000 in. I end most nights just walking around my bedroom like a drunk penguin. And some people don't even care how they make their 10,000. Did you know some individuals are placing wearable trackers on their small children or ceiling fans to rack up extra points? How mad's that? I want the world to know how healthy I am. Junior, get on the treadmill.
the Russell Howard hour there from England. In my case, I realized at one point with those early Fitbits that were pretty sensitive, even if you were having a beer, it would count steps for you. So it's pretty interesting. Now, anyone with a fitness tracker will tell you that the 10,000 step goal can become a bit of an obsession, as he was alluding to. But where exactly did it come from? I mean, it's a nice round number, right? But is it actually based on any kind of science? Well, not really. In fact, not really at all. It was kind of invented back in the 60s, mid-60s, in Japan. And there is a reason why 10,000 seemed like such a good number. They were trying to sell pedometers, needless to say. Trying to sell pedometers in the aftermath of the 1964 Tokyo Olympics. And they thought, you know, obviously when there's an Olympics, people get a little bit health obsessed. And they thought, okay, well, how are we going to sell these pedometers? What's a nice round number? So they came up with this. Now, don't take my word for it, because my next guest is actually the one who dug into this. Dr. Aimin Lee is a professor at Harvard's Medical School, and she does research into physical activity. And a few years back, a while back now, she was asked to enter one of those office step competitions with a team. So she decided to look into exactly where this nice round number came from and whether it's actually based on any kind of science and whether or not you actually need, is it beneficial really to get to 10,000 steps? Or as Steve was saying earlier for his 84-year-old friend who does 5,000 steps a day, can you find the benefits without doing that much walking? So Dr. Aimin Lee, professor of medicine at Harvard, epidemiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and a researcher on physical activity, joins me now. Dr. Lee, thank you.
My pleasure. It's lovely to join you.
One of the things I found so interesting that I believe you were maybe not the first to find, but certainly the first to make known on this continent, was where exactly did this 10,000 step thing come from? Because it's not new, not by a long shot.
So if I can give you a little bit of a story, it all started because my organization, like many, you know, is doing a health promotion campaign and we're supposed to form teams and sort of compete with each other, collect steps. And my administrator said, well, you do physical activity research, go form a team. And so my team members were people like me, you know, older women, and some of us found it difficult to get to 10,000 steps, which is what the default goal is on many of our wearables. So I started to think, okay, you know, 10,000, why 10,000? And in doing some digging, I found that, yes, if you can get to this 10,000 goal, that's fantastic, but it never started off really based on scientific evidence. The first commercial pedometer was actually invented by a Japanese company, and they had pedometer that was a face that went from 0 to 10,000. And the Japanese word for 10,000 is a single word. It's not like 10,000. So 10,000 is a word called man. And they call this the manpoke, or the 10,000 step meter. And that was marketed right after the time of the Tokyo Olympics. You know, the researchers there had been concerned about people putting on weight, and they thought, you know, this might be a good number to get people to be physically active and perhaps mitigate weight gain. And in fact, if you go to the website of this manufacturer, they do say that, you know, this was something that they thought of, but it wasn't really based on hard scientific evidence the way that we thought it should be. And so I had to study a cohort of about 17,000 older women, and I thought it would be really interesting to look at these older women and see, okay, number of steps that they'd taken. We had followed them over a period of years to look at the women taking different number of steps to see whether, you know, you really needed to get to the 10,000. And that's good news for everybody, meaning that, you know, you can sort of pick your target. So as we all know, some physical activity is better than none. More is better up to a certain point. And then, of course, benefits plateau because we all have to die of something sometime. So the more steps you take, the better off you are. But interestingly enough, the benefits for these older women tapered at around 7,500 steps. So clearly, before you get to the 10,000, you will see significant health benefits, at least in this older women. It probably differs a little bit depending on whether you're older or younger. So when I say older, it'll be something like older than 60 years of age. You probably get maximum benefit around 6,000 to 8,000 steps. If you're younger than 60, it's 8,000 to 10,000 steps. But you don't have to reach that magic number. It's sort of on a sliding scale. If you do a little bit, you get some benefit. You do more, you get more benefit, and it plateaus at the point that I talked about.
Yeah, interesting. So the 10,000 steps thing, and I should mention, you're referring to the 1964 Tokyo Olympics, not the ones we just had, right? So this goes back decades and decades, right? This goes back more than 60 years, or 60 years exactly at this point. So the whole 10,000 steps thing was really more of a Japanese marketing thing than it was based on any real science.
Correct. So it was based on marketing because of the number. It was also based on, you know, that belief that if you walked at this level, you would expend a certain number of calories and therefore you would mitigate weight gain. So you're correct in that there was no direct evidence linking the number of steps to, you know, a certain outcome or not.
Right.
And I had actually heard one of the early investigators, his name is Dr. Yoshiro Hatano. He was from Kyushu University and he did some research for that company. In one of these talks I attended, he said that if you look at the Japanese character for man, which is 10,000, it looks like a man walking.
Ah.
It really does.
Right. So in other words, it's the self-propagating thing that's happened. And none of us can really, it's also, I mean, it's a very alluring number, isn't it? In some ways, because, you know, you go from four digits to five, there's a lot of zeros in it. There is something psychological about the 10,000 step mark.
It is a lovely round number. And I have to admit that when I was in this group that was doing the steps, there were people, including myself, that would say at the end of the day, if we hadn't reached that 10,000, we would be walking around in our homes.
Of course, I do the same thing. I do the same thing. It is kind of ridiculous, but I do. Yeah.
Well, I suspect it has something to do with the people who wear these devices. We are probably a little bit obsessive. If we weren't, we wouldn't be carrying these devices. There are people who couldn't care less about them. You've probably heard of people who, you know, their kids, their relatives, their friends give them a device for their birthday, Christmas, and they say, oh, lovely, and they put it on and wear it 2 days and then it's in the back of the drawer. But for others, you know, they've probably been wearing it for a year, 5 years, 10 years, or even longer.
Yeah, you did find, I mean, of course, 10,000 steps is about 8 kilometers for if you're on this side of the border. That is an awfully long, that's a lot of walking, right? And it is difficult day in, day out to put that many steps in. So you found that, I mean, what you were saying earlier is that you don't really need to hit 10,000, that 7,500 is good. And many people walk far less than that, of course.
Yes. So two parts to this. First, you do need far less than that, particularly if you're someone older. And second, it seems like a lot, but it really is not a lot. What do I mean by it? Because in the past, when we tell people, oh, you have to go walk a mile, go walk 2 miles or go walk 30 minutes. It's going out and intentionally walking to exercise or walking for physical activity. But when you record data using these wearables, it's recording every single step that I take. And so the steps that you take that you don't really think of that you are walking, it actually adds up. And what do I mean by that? So I have a fairly sedentary job. I sit in my office. I don't do very much. But in the course of my workday, I can easily put 3,000 steps on my pedometer doing nothing. So the steps that you take when you get up in the morning, you go from your bedroom to the bathroom, that's 10 steps. When you go from the bathroom to the kitchen, that's 20 steps. All these steps actually count, which is why it makes, you know, the 7,000, 7,500 number really not that large.
That's one of the things that's been interesting about having wearables. If you're someone who's used to going for a run, for instance, and you had that monitored, the wearables do show you how much activity you get during the day, even just by, you know, taking the stairs or taking the extra block, getting off the bus, a stop early, walking to the grocery store. I mean, it's amazing how quickly it adds up. I guess it's just, it feels like that last couple of kilometers is tough.
Yeah, and it's really true that if we have the mindset of moving or using our own feet, for example, to run errands, it's good for the climate, it's good for health. Like once you have this mindset of moving, it may add up more steps than you realize. So of course, everybody's schedules has been ended by the pandemic. But prior to the pandemic, I used to religiously go to the gym 5 days a week, and the other days I did not go to the gym. But I also live in a place where it's not easy to park your car, so I walk a lot. And I don't think of it as I'm walking for exercise. You know, I have to go to the post office. I have to go buy milk. It was not uncommon that the days that I did not go to the gym, I had more steps on my pedometer than on the days that I did go to the gym wearing my pedometer.
Yeah, that was always the famous, I remember a friend of mine from Europe would always say that for him, the typical North American was someone who took the elevator up 40 floors to go to the Stairmaster, right? To go to the gym and to get on the Stairmaster. That's what he thought.
That is true. And if you talk to people throughout the U.S. in places like New York, for example, where everybody has to take the subway because you can't park your car and people walk blocks. Just, you know, that's your daily life. They tend to get more steps than if you live in somewhere more open, say like Florida or Texas, where it's easier to drive and park your car. Like for many of us, if you go to the grocery store, you'll be like driving around and finding the spot closest to the entrance, wasting petrol, and you're also wasting your time. You know, if you just went in and parked at the first spot that you saw and then just walked through the grocery door, or, you know, stop, if you take public transportation, stop at the stop one before your actual stop and walk the last stop. If this becomes sort of a habit, I think one can actually accumulate more steps than you realize.
Dr. Aimin Lee is with us this half hour, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School in Boston or Cambridge, and a researcher into physical activity. We've been talking about this 10,000 step idea because it seems so absolutely ingrained in our society these days that 10,000 steps is some sort of gold standard for your daily physical activity. Dr. Lee, does it matter how fast you're walking? Because, of course, I'm just wondering about sort of accumulating the steps. Should you be getting a good brisk walk in each and every day, or is it just getting those steps good enough?
So the answer may be a little bit complicated, but bear with me. If you accumulate more steps in a day, you obviously have to be walking at a faster clip than someone who accumulates fewer steps, right? Because everybody only has, if you sleep 8 hours, everybody only has 16 hours in the day. So the relevant question is for two people who have the same number of steps, if you walk the steps faster and then, you know, are sedentary the rest of the time, does it make a difference? And so far, the research has been mixed. It's not clear that the pace of walking contributes additionally above and beyond the number of steps that you take.
Right. So is it worth having one of these monitors then? Because you're right, certain people like them because you get a bit obsessive with them, right? But is it worth having them? Do you think it makes a difference? Or should you just follow some of your advice about getting as many steps in a day as you can and not necessarily keeping wrapped or keeping close count of them every single day?
I think each one of us should do what works for us, right? So some people like to record their steps, then go ahead and do that. Some people don't want to. And actually, our health guidelines tell us to be physically active in terms of time, because these guidelines were developed for the U.S. The latest federal guidelines were released in 2018 for the World Health Organization. Their latest guidelines were released in 2020. So at least for these iterations of the guidelines, they're actually time-based metrics because they're based on data, and most of the data that has existed prior to the last few years did not make use of wearables because wearables had not existed for research. And these metrics actually ask us to be physically active at a moderate intensity for 150 minutes a week. So you can think of that as, for example, 30 minutes of walking 5 days a week. So some people prefer time-based metrics, and if you prefer time-based metrics, go for it. If you're someone who likes to count your steps, use a wearable by all means. And there is some research that suggests that for certain people, at least, looking at the number can motivate you. So there have been studies that have provided our patients with a pedometer, and people who could monitor their steps and were told to be physically active, as compared to people who were told to be physically active and did not monitor their steps, the ones who did monitor their steps, on average, they got about 2,000, 2,500 more steps a day. So it can be an incentive for some. But remember, the people in this study were the people who signed up for it. So you have to know yourself.
Right. So the brass tacks here is that if you've done 9,712 steps one day and you're sitting on the couch and you're thinking, you don't really have to get up and walk those last 300 unless you're absolutely, absolutely committed to getting to that 10,000. It doesn't really have that much of a health difference.
No, it doesn't. And also, it's really the average that matters, because if you look at the research studies that have looked at steps and health outcomes, they don't look at it day by day. Most of the time, they average the steps over a period of a week. So it's what you've done on average over the week. So there also has been research looking at so-called weekend warriors, people who accumulate a large number of their steps.
That's what I do. Yeah.
You know, what's the best physical activity for you? The best physical activity for you is the one that you like to do and you can stick with. So if that works for you, you know, that, and your average over the week is good, that's fine. Having said that, we still try to encourage people to be physically active on a more regular basis, because one, it encourages the habit, and secondly, you're less likely to get injuries because you are sort of doing a smaller number regularly versus doing nothing and then keeping a big amount of physical activity over a day or two.
Right. Did you break your 10,000 step habit? Is that or do you still do it?
I still do it.
Of course.
I'm in research. I like to count.
Of course. Yes. Dr. Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.